Hi, Marco Werman here. Thank you for listening to The World. You already know that our team works hard to find fresh angles and unique voices when we bring you the news. Our stories are global, but we aim to keep the focus local, with the people on the ground living close to the day's events. We're able to keep our coverage free and accessible and reach millions of people each week because listeners like you support our nonprofit newsroom. This is our fall fundraising drive, which means it is the perfect time to donate. If you give before November 30th and help us reach our goal, your gift will be matched. That means your support will go twice as far in helping us bring you the news. So if you've been thinking about donating but haven't yet, now is your chance. We can't do this without you. Visit theworld.org/give to double your impact today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you. And now, the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all of these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise also has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Border tensions today on The World, where Poland and Belarus meet, and at the U.S.-Mexico border, tensions of a different sort. A public health order still allows U.S. officials to turn back asylum seekers.
I don't think there is an awareness of the desperation that they're causing with these border policies.
Also today, Russia blows up a satellite, leaving astronauts out there with a lot of dangerous debris.
And so essentially, they're like bullets that are racing roughly 17,500 miles per hour.
I'm Marco Werman, and a volcano has been erupting for 2 months on Spain's Canary Islands. Ash is everywhere, even in beehives.
They dug out the hives, and five of the hives were absolutely fine.
We'll hear about the rest of the island and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us. We begin today at the border of Poland and Belarus, where the migrant crisis continues to escalate. Thousands are trying to cross into Poland to seek asylum in the European Union.
If you don't follow the orders, force may be used against
you. A police recording on a loudspeaker tells migrants that force may be used against you. And it was. In freezing conditions, Polish border police fired water cannons and tear gas at the migrants. Some migrants threw stones at the police. Joining us now is Katia Glod. She's a senior fellow with the Center for European Policy Analysis in London. How is the European Union reacting, Katia, to these unfolding events on the Polish-Belarusian border?
Well, yesterday the European Union held a meeting where it decided on the new package of sanctions against Belarus. Also, last night there was a phone call between the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and the leader of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko. And it seems that phone call was rather successful. There are signs that the Belarusian authorities are looking at ways to de-escalate the situation. And it seems that the regime in Belarus at least is trying to open up a humanitarian corridor. And tonight we also saw some news from Belarus that the big crowd of migrants was brought into a facility into the venue, like a big logistic sense and not far from the border checkpoints. And it seems that at least tonight, the people will stay warm and will have some food and some shelter.
So, Katia, you said there's a facility now open for some of the migrants, but the latest pushback was with water cannon and freezing weather. What do we know about the conditions of the migrants right now?
Well, we know that their conditions have been really appalling. People have been trapped between Poland, de facto, and Belarus. Other people who are trapped in the forest between the two countries, they've been in very bad conditions. All of them really lack food. They don't have enough water. Over the past few days, the Belarusian authorities have been bringing at least some firewood for them so they can light some fires.
What exactly are the goals of Belarus and its ally Russia in this situation? And what does it tell us that Belarus, as you say, may be on the verge of de-escalating things along their border with Poland?
Yes, well, initially, the regime in Belarus initiated this crisis, most likely with the goal to have the European Union sanctions revoked, the sanctions that the European Union had been imposing on Belarus over the past 18 months. These are the sanctions that are hitting Belarus very badly. And the regime obviously suffers. It does not want that. But the sanctions were imposed in the first place because of the fraudulent election in Belarus in August 2020 and because of very high level of repression against civil society. Today, we have in Belarus over 840 political prisoners. And then thousands of people have been prosecuted and have gone through prison in one way or another.
Well, there's a lot of consideration about how to isolate Belarus. Neighboring Lithuania's foreign minister suggested a no-fly zone over the Minsk International Airport to keep migrants from landing there and then going straight to the border. What do you make of that suggestion? Do you think it's even realistic?
I don't think that actually having a no-fly zone is a realistic solution, but imposing sanctions on those airlines which are engaged into this human trafficking effort, that would be quite realistic.
So, Katya, more sanctions, a phone call from Angela Merkel to Minsk. What will you be looking for from Belarus in terms of de-escalation to know that it's authentic?
We need to see the number of migrants coming into Belarus going down. That would be the very first sign. Another sign would be whether the Belarusian authorities would allow these migrants to travel back to Minsk and then help them get home. Because what is happening at the moment, why these people are trapped in the forest between the two borders, is because the Belarusian authorities, are particularly security services and the army, don't allow them to go back to Minsk. They want them to stay there and to create this very bad situation. But it seems that now Lukashenko is quite scared that it might play against him and the situation might get out of control because there are large numbers of migrants within also, you know, not only at the border, but some of them obviously in Belarusian cities, and that creates tension within society, which is overwhelmingly white, etc.
Katya Glod is a senior fellow with the Center for European Policy Analysis. She joined us from London. Katya, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The International Space Station has a problem, Russian space debris. Yesterday, Russia used a missile to destroy one of its own satellites, sending more than 1,500 pieces of debris skittering across Earth's orbit. It forced astronauts on the space station to take shelter in a pair of spacecraft capable of getting them back to Earth. Lauren Grush is a space reporter for The Verge and knows a lot about space junk. Lauren, why is space debris dangerous?
Well, I think it's important to understand that the satellites and debris that are orbiting Earth aren't just floating up there leisurely. They're moving at a very speedy pace. And so essentially, they're like bullets that are racing roughly 17,500 miles per hour.
So let me fall back on pop culture here. In the movie Gravity, when Sandra Bullock is in Earth's orbit and all this debris is hurtling her way at thousands of miles an hour, that's not an exaggeration.
It's not. And in fact, there were a lot of allusions to that movie, Gravity, yesterday, because what did end up happening was very similar to the plot of that film.
Well, let's go through that. After the satellite was blown up yesterday, it triggered a drama. What happened first?
So early in the morning, before 2 a.m. Eastern time, NASA woke up the crew of the International Space Station and warned them that, hey, we've have this recording of the satellite breaking up. We're going to need you to take cover. So the astronauts will shelter in place inside of their vehicles that are docked to the ISS, presumably so that if something did happen, let's say there was a depressurization event on the ISS, then they could easily undock and return home.
Lauren, a key question here. Why would Russia blow up their own satellite?
What Russia did was called essentially an anti-satellite or ASAT test, and it's really a show of strength, right? It's showing to other countries that, hey, I have the capability to blow up a satellite in orbit. Yes, they blew up their own satellite, but presumably they have the option to, say, blow up an American satellite if we have unfriendly terms in the near future. But obviously, they're very much condemned among the space community because of their propensity to create thousands of pieces of uncontrollable debris that then threatens other satellites and now presumably astronauts in low Earth orbit.
Do other country space programs do ASAT tests?
Yes, there have been very notable ASAT tests in the past. In 2007, China destroyed one of its own satellites, which then created thousands of pieces of debris. So they create this like large cloud of debris that is menacing for years to come. In fact, the International Space Station just had to move out of the way of one of those fragments from the 2007 test that China did just last week. Now, I want to say that the U.S. is also not absolved here. We also did our own ASAT test in 2008, where we took out a failing satellite under the guise that had toxic hydrazine in it and it was falling out of orbit. So we ended up destroying it as a safety measure, but it also allowed us to test out our own ASAT technology as well.
Mm. Did that also lead to a lot of space junk?
It was falling out of orbit. When it's closer to the Earth, the pieces will fall out of Earth's orbit faster. But when you have a satellite that's, you know, roughly at the level of the International Space Station, like the Russians just did, you know, that debris is going to last for many, many years.
Lauren, it seems like every few years another nation flexes its muscles and takes out one of its satellites as a show of military capability. But along with satellite development and replacement, I mean, it's all led to a lot of hazardous junk. Isn't there some kind of space treaty to put an end to all this?
Well, we actually do have a space treaty. It's called the Outer Space Treaty, which defines guidelines by which we're supposed to operate in space. However, that treaty was written to be vague on purpose because we want to have some leeway in terms of how we explore space. So it doesn't outright ban ASAT tests like this. However, I'm sure the conversation will be reignited in light of this test because this specific ASAT test did have an impact on the International Space Station and on the Russians' own cosmonauts. There are two cosmonauts currently on board the ISS who had to also shelter in place.
Lauren Grush is a reporter for The Verge, where she covers all things space. Lauren, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This morning, in the capital of Uganda, Kampala, two apparent suicide attacks killed several people. The bombings come at a time of rising concern about the threat of terrorism in Uganda and the region. The world's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi has more.
The first explosion happened outside of the central police station in Kampala. People were out and about in the downtown area. CCTV footage released by authorities shows a man with a bag approaching the building. Then there's a blast, and the chaos that followed was captured in video footage posted on social media. Videos show people running in different directions as smoke fills the air. Just 3 minutes after the first bomb, another explosion went off, this time near Uganda's parliament building. Surveillance videos show two suspects approaching a busy street on a motorcycle. First responders were quick to the scene. I spoke with Irene Nakasita of the Uganda Red Cross. She was at the scene of one of the explosions today.
By the time people called us in, of course, the scene was still terrible. People were really scampering and scattering. And, of course, that was fresh just after the bomb blast.
At least three people were confirmed dead, in addition to the three suicide bombers. Dozens of bystanders were injured, including police officers.
There are those that had big wounds. There are those that were not breathing so well, required resuscitation, required oxygen.
Later in the day, police spokesman Fred Nganga described the two explosions as acts of domestic terrorism.
We wish to inform the public that we've registered two separate deadly suicide attacks within Kampala City.
He added that police arrested a fourth suspect and recovered two undetonated bombs. Today's explosions come after a string of recent terrorist attacks in Uganda. Last month, separate explosions killed two people at a restaurant and on a bus.
And our intelligence also indicates that these are domestic terror groups that are linked to ADF.
ADF, stands for the Allied Democratic Forces. The group originated in northern Uganda in the 1990s as an Islamist anti-government movement, but the ADF is now based in neighboring Democratic Republic of the Congo. Earlier this year, the United States designated the group as an affiliate of ISIS. While the exact nature of that relationship remains unclear, it does appear that the ADF continues to pose a security threat to Uganda. Here is police spokesman Fred Nganga again.
The bomb threats are still active, especially from suicide attackers. We believe there are still more members of these domestic terror cells.
Here in neighboring Kenya, authorities are also on high alert. In response to the recent attacks in Uganda, Kenyan police say they're heightening security at its borders. For The World, I'm Halima Kikandi in Nairobi.
In Cuba yesterday, an organized protest against the government was quashed by neighborhood security forces taunting would-be protesters at their doorsteps. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Last week, the U.S. reopened its land borders to vaccinated travelers, but those borders remain closed for many asylum seekers, even if they are vaccinated. That's because President Biden is continuing a public health order called Title 42. The Trump administration put the order in place at the start of the pandemic. It lets border officials quickly turn back asylum seekers. Reporter Max Rivlin-Nadler tells us how it's leaving migrants in Tijuana, Mexico, increasingly desperate.
Psychologist Sebastian Farias walks through a makeshift camp for asylum seekers set up at a port of entry in Tijuana. He's meeting with a family of eight that has been here on and off for months. Farias is with Psicológicos Sin Fronteras, or Psychologists Without Borders, a nonprofit that offers counseling to migrants. He listens as the family talks about the difficulties they've faced in Tijuana. All Farias can do is listen to them because, right now, there's no way for the family to claim asylum in the U.S.
Las personas tienen un grado de ansiedad bastante elevado. Te digo, cambios conductuales como el de no querer salir a la tienda, eso ya indica.
Being stuck in the migrant encampment, Farias says they face serious anxiety, behavioral swings, there's fear and depression daily. And now, there's a large fence surrounding the encampment. Local officials say it's for safety, but migrants say they feel under surveillance. 21-year-old Jackie is a member of the family Farias spoke with. She doesn't want to use her full name for fear of being found by people from her hometown. She says they fled a part of Mexico where powerful gangs are battling for turf. The family tried recently to cross into the U.S., but were turned away by Border Patrol because of Title 42, the federal health order that allows officials to do that.
Sí, fue horrible porque nos tocaron muchos personas de ahí de inmigración, muy racistas, demasiado racistas.
She says immigration officials were racist toward her. She says they were treated like insects. Migrants and their advocates hoped that President Biden would have ended Title 42. But 11 months on, White House officials say the health order is still needed to protect the U.S. from COVID-19. Judith Cabrera is with the Borderline Crisis Center, a nonprofit that offers advice to migrants and sometimes a place to stay. Cabrera says with Title 42, the U.S. is convincing many migrants to turn to smugglers to cross the border, sometimes with deadly consequences if they're left in remote parts of the desert or kidnapped and held for ransom by criminal groups.
I don't think there is an awareness of the desperation that they're causing with these border policies. So they put it on smugglers, they put it on the migrant community.
Instead of waiting for a chance to enter the U.S., some migrants are seeking asylum in Mexico. Gilberto Herrera is the federal government's delegate to Tijuana. He says the Mexican government is working to speed up the asylum process and streamline getting work permits.
Se han generado nuevas oportunidades de trabajo en México.
If people want to work, he says, there are opportunities in Mexico. Big government projects underway need workers, he says. 21-year-old Antonio Rodriguez is an asylum seeker from Honduras who also lives in the encampment in Tijuana. He got a work visa and is now employed by a construction company, but he still faces danger in Mexico. He says he's been kidnapped multiple times. One time, he says he watched his kidnappers execute another man right in front of him.
Que México no era seguro para mí. Yo me puse a analizar muchas cosas.
No,
Mexico isn't safe for me, he says. He still hopes to apply for asylum in the U.S.
Y yo le pedí a Dios, yo le oraba a Dios que él ganara. No está cumpliendo en nada, y pues aquí estamos.
He says he prayed to God that after Biden was elected, he'd end Title 42. That hasn't happened, but Rodriguez says that, despite the horrific risks, he'll stay in Tijuana until the U.S. changes its policies to get his claim at asylum. For The World, I'm Max Rivlin-Adler in Tijuana.
In Cuba yesterday, the plan was for nationwide street protests, demands for more political freedoms, a repeat of this past summer's unprecedented demonstrations. But instead, the people who took to the streets were police officers, state security agents, and government supporters. They kept protesters from leaving their homes. Lilian Guerra is a professor of Cuban history and the director of the Cuba program at the University of Florida. So many of the government supporters, Lilian, in the streets yesterday were members of local neighborhood groups known as the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution. Explain what they are all about.
Well, Committees for the Defense of the Revolution began to exist in around September of 1960 in the lead up to the U.S. invasion at the Bay of Pigs. They were, in the minds of many Cubans, supposed to be a temporary organization designed to prevent people who had sympathies for the counter-revolution from acting on those sympathies. However, after 1961, in fact, they became the backbone of surveillance for the government. They still exist on every block. You're supposed to register before the age of six. You're supposed to pay a monthly quota to be a member. You're supposed to attend all their meetings. The reality is, since 1991, most people don't attend the meetings. A lot of people, if not the majority, don't pay their quotas. And yet, this network, which is comprised of millions of Cubans, is very active. Fidel called them 1 million mouth shutters. They were designed to shut people up. And they do that. They are supposed to call out those who publicly protest or publicly complain in any way, shape, or form, the existence of the state, the policies of the state, etc.
So what evidence have you seen that members of these Revolutionary Defense Committees were part of the very successful suppression of the protesters yesterday?
Yeah, we saw the rehashing of tactics that really the CDRs have not used in decades, in particular the use of the meeting of repudiation. This is where you get groups of activists from either your local CDR, people from other CDRs, to go to neighborhoods, stand in front of the house of a dissident or somebody who sympathizes with the dissidents, shout slogans, they intimidate, they taunt. This is a tactic that really was on display in 1980 when more than 120,000 Cubans registered to leave the country during the Mariel boat lift. What's different here is the reality that yesterday we saw meetings of repudiation taking place live streamed on Facebook by their victims. And these people didn't want to leave the country. They wanted to stay. All they wanted to do was leave their home so they could go out onto the street, march peacefully, and protest for change.
Do CDR committee members carry weapons? I mean, did they ever have that kind of power?
They never did have that kind of power. What they did have was a direct line to the police and to the Ministry of the Interior. CDRs have archives on every single person in their block. They issue political evaluations on that person from cradle to grave. In the past and in the present, in order to get anywhere in life, to get a promotion at your job, you actually have to have a recommendation from your CDR.
Do members of the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, are they older or are they getting younger members now?
Well, the interesting thing is that the activists, the people who are the president of the CDR and that hold these sort of political offices, there's not a lot of turnover. I mean, I know some CDRs in Centro Habana, for instance, have been headed by the same person for literally 60 years.
Wow.
It is perhaps difficult for us to understand, but that kind of symbolic form of power where they get to be the deputies of the state and the surrogates for Fidel or Raul, that is something that really is incomparable in our society, but it is really, really important in Cuba, where people generally live very poorly and where everybody is more equally poor than rich. And so much of people's prosperity and opportunities depend on loyalty to the state.
Lilian Guerra is a professor of Cuban history and the director of the Cuba program at the University of Florida. Lilian, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Migrants from the Middle East and Africa take rubber boats to get to Europe. Destination, Greece. They're claiming that Greek authorities are casting them back out to sea.
It begins to be like Bermuda Triangle, but for people.
And a change to the color of the French flag? Sacré bleu, literally. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The day after President Biden and Chinese Premier Xi Jinping had their first virtual summit, Chinese state media are calling it historic. The World's Rebecca Canther is on the line with us from Shanghai to tell more about the reaction in China. So how did the summit go over in China? Headlines suggest it was a big deal there.
There was a lot of attention from state media and also on social media. There were updates before, during the break, and after the summit. Before the summit even started, there was already talk of it as being a win for China because it was scheduled at night U.S. hours. People here perceive that as China having the upper hand since Xi Jinping didn't have to stay up late at night. Other people thought that showed that the U.S. was really committed, and one person even joked online, the U.S. is working overtime to improve China-U.S. relations. So I spoke with Wu Xinbo. He's the director of the Center for American Studies at Fudan University in Shanghai. And he said the most important outcome of the summit was just that it actually happened.
And also their conversation suggests that they want to promote cooperation in some concrete issue areas.
He means areas like trade and climate change.
And what did the Chinese media focus on once the 3+ hour summit wrapped?
The big takeaway in Chinese state media and social media was all about Taiwan. All the headlines here were saying that Biden was saying the U.S. would not support Taiwan independence. But that didn't satisfy many people here. Wu Xinbo also talked about this.
He could use much stronger words, for example, oppose Taiwan independence. And also, more importantly, it's not just a matter of rhetoric, it's a matter of action.
What he's saying is he wanted to hear Biden say something stronger, like the U.S. opposes Taiwan independence. People on social media were echoing that. They were saying it doesn't matter what the U.S. says about Taiwan, it matters what they do. And right now, what they want to see is the U.S. really aligning more on this one China stance and distancing itself from Taiwan. And so much of the rest of Biden's remarks didn't make it into the news at all. He made mentions of human rights. That definitely was not reported here.
I mean, we should point out that talking about Taiwan for any U.S. president is really an exercise in walking a tightrope. You support Beijing's one China policy, but also trying to assert diplomatically to China that they should not try and undermine the status quo of Taiwan. From your perch in Shanghai, Rebecca, what actual tactile results do you expect to come out of this summit?
Well, few people I talked to felt like anything really substantial was going to come out of the summit directly. Most felt it was like a steering of the relationship in the right direction. A state media reporter in his closing remarks at the end of the summit said Chinese people shouldn't expect the relationship between the two countries to go back to what it was, but that the relationship was building regardless. I spoke with a businesswoman who works on a lot of U.S.-China projects. She says she thinks the trade relationship between the U.S. and China will, in fact, improve. She thinks tariffs will be lowered. And today, actually, Chinese state media mentioned a couple of interesting things. One, they said there could be a new fast-track visa program for American business people coming to China. And then there was one other hopeful sign, which is that in state media here, there was a report that the U.S. has pledged to issue longer visas for Chinese journalists, and China will do the same for American journalists. And that's been a real point of conflict and a sign of tension between the two countries, as the number of U.S. journalists in China has really dwindled. So those are two small signs. Haven't seen much else yet.
The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Where is Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai? A couple of weeks ago, she publicly accused a retired Communist Party official of sexual assault. China's internet firewall immediately kicked into action. Internet searches for her name were blocked, even searches for the word tennis. And now, apparently, Peng Shuai herself is missing. No one has heard from her in 10 days. The hashtag, Where is Peng Shuai, is trending on Twitter. International tennis stars like Billie Jean King and Chris Evert are asking about her whereabouts. And on Sunday, the Women's Tennis Association took the unusual step of issuing a statement. The WTA said Peng Shuai and all women deserve to be heard, not censored. The erupting volcano on the island of La Palma is a story we've been following for nearly 2 months now. La Palma is one of Spain's Canary Islands off the Moroccan coast. The volcano has put on a spectacular show, shooting glowing lava far into the sky, but it then streams through villages and lush banana plantations, leaving a path of destruction on its way to the sea. Today, the Cumbre Vieja volcano is still erupting. Reporter Barbara Belt has spent the day traveling around the island. She joins us from Santa Cruz de la Palma. What did you see today, Barbara? Can you give us some snapshots of scenes you came across?
I woke up this morning to thick ash everywhere, and that got slowly worse as the morning wore on. And what I could see from where I was, which was down in the port in Tasacorte, right below the volcano, was the Fahana, the new part of the island that's being created, the lava going into the sea and massive columns of white vapor coming up. So bad air quality is what I felt, and dark skies and rain is what there was and what I saw.
Mm. I'm curious, how many miles approximately are you from the volcano? I'm just trying to get a sense of how large the danger zone is.
The danger zone is all down the west coast of the island. And I've come over the ridge through a tunnel, which was about to be closed. Had that shut down, everybody would have been stuck on the island. And there are lots of volcano tourists here.
Right now, there are tourists that have come to see mm-hmm. the Cumbre Vieja. How are locals reacting to that?
Pretty well. They're pleased about the tourist bucks that it's bringing in. And everybody's fairly well behaved. Quite a few little local outfits have set themselves up as instant volcano excursion organizers.
A little surprise, based on your descriptions, Barbara, that local residents have had their lives turned upside down. You spoke with a town hall worker named Carmen.
Angustia. Angustia.
Sí. Y
muchas ganas de que termine. Porque a partir de ahí podemos empezar de cero.
What were you and Carmen talking about? What did she tell you?
She said angustia, anguish. Anguish and with lots of desire that it finishes soon so that everybody can take stock and begin their lives again. Everything's on hold.
More than 7,000 local residents have been evacuated, thousands of homes destroyed. Is the government on the Spanish mainland getting residents the help they need?
In theory, there's a great deal of help. There are 20 million euros that have just been seeded by national government, backed by the European government in Brussels, which is all there ready and waiting, supposedly, for compensation for people who've lost their homes. And therein lies a more complicated story.
What is the more complicated story?
Well, you can't start repopulating an area which is still undergoing a volcanic eruption because more lava could come down. You could set something up, move people into it, and then the lava would come down.
I mean, briefly, what kind of relationship generally does Madrid have with the Canary Islands?
Pretty good at the moment, largely due to the current political situation, which is Spain, as you probably know, has got one of the only slightly left-wing governments in Europe at the moment, and they are very much in favour of benefits. There are lots of benefits coming down to the Canaries generally, also backed by EU funding. And Pedro Sanchez, the Spanish Prime Minister, has been down here now four times and is very active and is seen to be active.
Well, people in the Canaries obviously affected by the volcano. The volcano has also brought pressure on biodiversity. In recent days, we've learned about the fate of some of the bees on the island, and I gather those bees were able to survive being buried in ash. Explain that.
I know. Isn't it incredible? Really, we are so pathetic compared to the rest of the species on the planet at looking after ourselves. Oh, it's extraordinary. So this is a beekeeper who had six hives. And they subsequently got buried in volcanic ash. They dug out the hives, and five of the hives were absolutely fine. So this constitutes thousands of bees. There's something like 20 to 1,000 bees in each one. What had happened was the bees had blocked off the entrance to the hive with propolis. And the reason that they'd managed to survive in there is that the beekeeper, who was feeling very guilty because he hadn't cleaned the combs and taken the honey out, had left the combs full of honey. So they actually had plenty of food to survive whilst they were down there.
Well, wow. They blocked it with what?
Propolis.
What is propolis?
Well, oh, it's very fashionable. It's,
yeah,
I don't
I'm
know,
so out of it.
Yeah, okay. Propolis is a concentrated substance that bees make from the pollen. This is sold now in health food shops across Europe as being very good for natural immunity and for building resistance to common germs. And so the bees actually used it to plug in the holes of the hive and survive, which is just extraordinary.
That
I think it's a lovely story.
Amazing, yeah. Barbara, one final scene from your tour of the island today. Two residents of La Palma, women named Mari and Nuria, you met them as they were brushing out ash from their small shop. Let's hear that. So, Barbara, what was the perspective of Mari and Nuria when you met them?
They're more afraid when it goes silent because what usually happens after a phase of silence is the whole thing just blows. There's either a new mouth blown in the volcanic cone, or there's a great lava rush, or there's a big gas expulsion. So when it goes completely quiet, everybody's kind of on tenterhooks. Oh God, what's going to happen now?
That is wild. Reporter Barbara Belt has spent the day traveling around La Palma, the site of a volcanic eruption that began almost 2 months ago on Spain's Canary Islands. Barbara, many thanks. Be safe.
You too. Thank you. Bye.
A disturbing trend seems to be playing out in the Mediterranean. Migrants heading toward islands in Greece by inflatable boats are allegedly being intercepted by Greek security forces, then abandoned at sea. This practice is known as a pushback. It's illegal under international law. A small group of people on a Greek island just a couple of miles from the Turkish coast are trying to expose and prevent this. From Samos, Andrew Connolly reports.
Hello!
It's approaching dusk in a valley near the northern coast of Samos, and a group of doctors are shouting into the wilderness. The international NGO Doctors Without Borders have received reports that a group of asylum seekers have arrived on the island.
They saw us. Apparently they saw the two cars and they're behind here.
The search moves into the woods.
Hello? Hello? Is someone here?
Doctors shine torches into the trees. Suddenly, one of their colleagues shouts that people have been spotted. There's a sense of urgency here. It's a race, because if the Greek authorities find the migrants first, they might not be seen again. Six young men from Somalia and Eritrea appear from the darkness. They've arrived by boat from Turkey, and they're afraid. They say some more are hiding in the woods, and others were already captured by police. Doctors drape thermal blankets around them and distribute water. According to European and international law, migrants landing on the island should be registered at a new EU-funded camp where their asylum claims are examined. And yet almost every day, the Turkish Coast Guard is finding boatloads of refugees drifting on the Aegean Sea. Many of the people on board claim that they were violently deported from the islands and towed into the middle of the water. Back at the Doctors Without Borders office, head of mission Patrick Wieland explains how they've started to intervene to prevent this.
After providing first aid and psychological first aid as well, we notify the police again that they come to pick them up and bring them for registration in the prison-like camp.
I accompany the doctors to another intervention. A group of 48 have just arrived on the island and are recovering outside a monastery. A young woman from Cameroon claims that she arrived on Samos last month, heavily pregnant, but was forced into a boat and abandoned at sea by Greek security forces. She shows us a video, apparently filmed just after the incident.
What are we watching here?
This woman was. This is a pushback, and she's in a dinghy, and she's on the point to deliver. And she says that on labor in the dinghy, and then they reached the Turkish coast. And then the ambulance came to take her to the hospital for the delivery.
The woman is now back on the island again, this time with her newborn baby, hoping to claim asylum. Local lawyer Dimitris Houlis has been raising awareness of alleged pushbacks by the Greek Coast Guard for years. It's not without risk. He faces accusations by politicians that he is facilitating illegal immigration or even colluding with smugglers, charges that he rejects.
We don't support smuggling, we don't support illegal migration, but we support the right of the illegal immigrant to apply for asylum. This is the important thing. We have to respect this right. If we cancel this right, then we cancel a right that humanity fought for.
The Greek government and Coast Guard, who didn't respond to the world's questions, consistently deny these reports, but I wonder if it's possible to prove it. I take a drive with Michael Svarnias, a local journalist. Michael says that locals often see migrants before they're pushed back, but police try to cover up that they were ever there.
There was a guy or a woman that told me that, yes, I am the one, I called police, who came here, and after 2 hours, 3 hours, the police came back and told me that this never happened, and they were on my yard, on my my house. I give them food, I give them water, and I am the one who calls the police. And after that, they disappear.
We hear a rumor that there's been a refugee boat arrival near the tiny village of Drakay, high up in the hills on the island's northwest.
The guy on the phone told me that there were a lot of life jackets in the sea. There.
Life jackets in the sea.
Yeah, and there was two patrol boats.
When we arrive, the local priest, Father Lefteris, confirms that around 30 refugees arrived in the village the previous evening. According to the law, the police should transfer them to the camp for registration. But when we check later, they aren't there, and no new registrations would be recorded for the next week. Other witnesses to the arrival at Drakay, some claiming to even have photos, were afraid to speak on the record. So for now, at least 30 people are missing. Just the latest in a string of unexplained disappearances on the island. Or, as Michael puts it,
so it begins to be like a Bermuda Triangle, but for the people, for people.
For the world, I'm Andrew Connolly, Samos, Greece.
Picture the French flag, vertical stripes of red, white, and royal blue. That is until French President Emmanuel Macron decided that navy would be so much more elegant. 16 months ago, Macron started changing the flags around his official residence. No one seemed to notice until yesterday. Now all of France is speculating, what could this mean? The French royal blue matches the EU flag. Is the shift a political message? Presidential aides say nope, Macron just likes navy. From a different point of view. Ever since the 1963 Sand War, as it was known, Morocco and Algeria have been uneasy neighbors. Both countries lay claim to a vast desert region in northwest Africa. For decades, a ceasefire has been in place, but in August, Morocco and Algeria cut diplomatic ties, and recently Morocco has been making power plays. Here's Nicholas Pelham, the Middle East correspondent for The Economist, explaining the growing rift.
I think what we're seeing is an increasing battle of hegemony between Algeria and Morocco over the region. Primarily, the struggle at the moment is focused on Western Sahara, which is a strip of land running south along the Atlantic coast towards West Africa. And that's where Morocco of late has been expanding its influence. It's pushed into a contested area at the southern rim of the Western Sahara. And Algerians are really not happy about it.
Last year, the U.S. was the first country to officially recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara, that strip of desert. This happened in exchange for Morocco recognizing Israel. The move emboldened Morocco, even though the land is claimed by the local inhabitants fighting for independence.
I was there a couple of weeks ago. I flew down from Casablanca to Dakhla. I remember Dakhla being a kind of small fishing village when I was in Morocco 20 years ago. Today, it's a kind of burgeoning resort. They've got sort of tourists coming in from Europe. They've got a lot of Moroccans flying in. And you speak to hotel operators, they're saying investors are coming in looking to buy up more land for development of hotels. You've got a new, really quite sizable port that's being built on the coast. You've got a new coastal road. You've got canning and fishing industries, new solar farms and wind farms under construction. The territory is now linked to the Moroccan grid. And you've had a really pretty large influx of Moroccans into Western Sahara to the point where the kind of local Sahrawi population is swamped. So there's really quite a lot of development going on.
So where does this leave Algeria? They're struggling to keep order within their own country and pushing back at the inroads Morocco has made in the region. Algeria has backed the nationalist movement, the Polisario Front. That's the main group seeking independence for Western Sahara. Algeria has also moved troops to the border. Again, Nicholas Pelham.
Both countries have a history of a war of words, but Morocco has been spending much more heavily on its military. Last year, it spent 30% more than previously. The Algerians have the continent's biggest military budget. The Moroccans have been pushing into a neutral zone in a contested area. They've been carrying out drone strikes, which killed a senior commando of Polisario. Algeria's been moving troops into the region. And then, you know, there are an increasing number of sort of flashpoints. In September, two Moroccan truck drivers were killed crossing the desert. Western diplomats suspect that perhaps, you know, Algerian intelligence could have had a hand in that. If other countries do start to be drawn into this spat, then yes, I think there's a real risk that we could be in for an escalation.
That's Middle East correspondent Nicholas Pelham on The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at The Economist, telling us about the tension between Morocco and Algeria over the territory of Western Sahara. Here's a problem that has plagued humanity for millennia, the hangover. Well, for those of us who drink alcohol anyway. For some, it's the hair of the dog. For others, it's a double cheeseburger and fries. In Israel recently, archaeologists discovered an ancient ring near a wine storehouse that may have been used as a hangover cure. Yeah, a ring, because back in ancient times, amethyst was believed to help reduce the next day headache. Ancient old wives' tale, or is there something to it? Shaughnessy Bishop Stahl has looked at the many solutions people have tried. He's the author of Hungover, The Morning After, and One Man's Quest for the Cure. He joins us from Toronto. Shaughnessy, gemstones with the power to tame a headache after a bender. It seems like miracle water. Does that idea surprise you?
No, it doesn't at all. Most old wives' tales have some piece of science in them that we might look on as magic now, but there's, you know, the line between magic and science has been thin throughout human history, and especially when it comes to anything to do with alcohol.
So what's the deal with amethyst?
It's one of these things where there's been a lot of broken telephone over the centuries or millennia.
By that you mean kind of misinformation that gets passed on and gets completely morphed in the process?
It gets morphed, very much so. There are, through the dozen or so years that I was researching the history of hangovers and hangover cures, I would come across references to amethyst quite often. And I actually did one hangover experiment where I used frankincense, myrrh, and gold, because there are some aspects of gold that are suggested to ward off the ill effects of alcohol, let's say.
How did that experiment work out for you?
Not very well. Most of my experiments did not work out very well for me. There used to be a good business in Victorian England where the chimney sweeps would get all the soot from inside the chimneys and sell them around Yuletide for people to put in their drinks in milk before they drank alcohol. It was supposed to purify them and stop their hangovers. It just made my tongue purple and made me very sick.
I was going to say it made the milk black.
Yeah, the frankincense is actually one that I still use in some of my tonics because it has extremely powerful anti-inflammatory properties.
I mean, is there a historical hangover cure you've uncovered that is actually based in science?
Oh, absolutely. Most of them, to tell you the truth. And it's hard to say if they're based in science or if science is based on them. So hangovers are prehistoric insofar as they existed before human history did.
Are you saying basically the hangover started as soon as humans discovered how to make alcohol?
Well, perhaps before so. Even when the apes and the bees would come across fermented fruit and fly around real weird and wake up not feeling too well. The hangovers may pre-exist humans. The first hangovers that we see recorded are in biblical texts or ancient scriptures. And in almost every one of those, there are references to things that to this day have scientific validity. One quick example, eggs of birds, fowl eggs, chicken eggs, have always been a part of breakfast. I never really stopped to think of why. You know, why is this a universality? One of the properties of a fowl egg or a chicken egg is something that is an amino acid called N-acetyl-L-cysteine. It is the main ingredient in the hangover concoction that I finally, after a dozen years of testing everything and trying everything, have settled upon.
Shaughnessy, Bishop Stahl's book is called Hungover, The Morning After and One Man's Quest for the Cure, helping us understand the history of and cures for the dreaded hangover. Shaughnessy, I will not thank you in moderation, though. Thank you very much. It was a great conversation.
It was nice to talk to you, Martha.
5 days a week, our editors bring you the latest news headlines straight to your inbox in our newsletter, Top of the World. You get 3 global stories you should know about, a few stories you might have missed, and of course, something to brighten your day. Subscribe to our daily newsletter on our website, theworld.org. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime. Again, that's at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow.